Hello and welcome to Background Briefing, available 24/7 at ianmasters.com. I'm Ian Masters, and today we'll look into a number of stories and issues in the news. We'll begin with an analysis of what goes on at Donald Trump's rallies, where his supporters often shout out, "Kill her," or "Kill the bitch," after Trump disparages his opponent, who he calls Crooked Hillary. Mark Potok, the director of the Southern Poverty Law Center's Intelligence Project and the editor of their journal Intelligence Report and the Hate Watch blog, joins us to discuss how Trump's campaign rhetoric both signals dangerous ideas to his more extreme followers and could inspire them to act on his call to arms to stop Hillary Clinton from taking away their guns, an absurd and frequent claim Trump's Second Amendment people believe. We will examine the belief system of Trump's more ardent and heavily armed followers, who see themselves as the real American patriots, who, in Thomas Jefferson's words, must refresh the tree of liberty from time to time with their blood and the blood of tyrants, who Jefferson clearly meant to be the King of England, not today's government of the United States. Then we'll look further into the possibility that Vladimir Putin is planning to restart his war with Ukraine using the absurd pretext of a hapless, overweight Ukrainian with soda bottles in a backpack that are supposed to be bombs, who allegedly killed a Russian intelligence officer and a soldier, although no bodies have been produced. Nevertheless, there is a massive military buildup underway on the de facto border between Crimea and Ukraine and in the Donbas. And Andrew Cutchins, a senior fellow at the Center for Eurasian, Russian, and Eastern European Studies at Georgetown University, joins us to discuss similarities to Putin's 2008 war with Georgia that broke out in August during a presidential election while everyone was watching the Beijing Olympics. Then finally, we'll discuss the just-released damning report by the Department of Justice on the Baltimore Police Department and speak with Kenneth Burns, a reporter for WYPR covering Baltimore City and Baltimore County. He is a member of the National Association of Black Journalists, and we'll examine the report which details systemic harassment of Baltimore's black citizens, one of whom, an African-American man in his 50s, was stopped 30 times in 5 years without an arrest. And joining us now is Mark Potok, who's the director of the Southern Poverty Law Center's Intelligence Project and the editor of his award-winning quarterly investigative journal, Intelligence Report. In addition to editing the magazine and the Hate Watch blog, Mark Potok acts as a key spokesperson for the SPLC, a well-known civil rights organization based in Montgomery, Alabama, and he has testified before the Senate, the United Nations High Commission on Human Rights, and other venues. Welcome to Background Briefing, Mark Potok.
Well, thanks so much for having me.
And people that have attended Trump rallies, along with journalists, many of whom have been corralled in little pens and some of them have been banned, have fairly consistently reported that people in the crowd, when he sort of stirs them up and talks about Crooked Hillary, say, "Kill her, kill the bitch," etc. Trump's own aide, close aide Roger Stone, has called for Hillary Clinton to be shot. No, he says she should be put in front of a firing squad and shot for treason. In May, the Secret Service investigated Donald Trump's butler over his Facebook post that said President Barack Obama should be shot as an enemy agent. And I believe the Secret Service also contacted the Trump campaign after Donald Trump's recent remarks a couple of days ago, where he sort of urged the Second Amendment people to stop Hillary Clinton from appointing judges to the Supreme Court. So what more evidence do we need that Donald Trump is inciting some rather dangerous people?
I don't think we need to drop more evidence. I think it's absolutely perfectly plain. You know, one of the things that I found most remarkable in recent weeks is a particular New York Times set of videos that were filmed at Trump rallies with Trump present. And the language at those rallies not only was racist to the point where we can't even use the words on the radio, but these things were said so loudly, they were shouted by huge groups of people, that there is no question at all that Donald Trump heard them. So in other words, Trump is used to presiding over rallies where people say things like "F that N-word," if I can say that on the radio. These really rather amazing statements. So, you know, when Trump plays the game of not being a racist or of not promoting violence at his rallies, he is simply lying. Let's remember, this is a man who has literally encouraged his followers to beat up protesters at his rallies. On two separate occasions, he offered to pay the legal fees of people who were arrested for beating up people at his rallies, including the man who was in fact criminally charged for sucker punching a Black Lives Matter demonstrator who was being led out of a rally by police.
So it's as though somehow we missed the obvious, because back in December, Donald Trump appeared on the radio show of the 9/11 conspiracy theorist promoter who has a large following, Alex Jones. And in that interview, Jones warned the listeners that the government was coming for our guns to enslave us. And Donald Trump said of Jones in this interview back in December the 2nd of last year, "Your reputation is amazing," Trump said. "I won't let you down." That's a pretty clear signal to Jones's constituency. And does Jones come up on your hate watch list?
Yeah, I mean, Alex Jones is virtually certainly the most prolific and unhinged conspiracy theorist in America. This is a guy who believes that the Oklahoma City bombing, the Boston Marathon bombing, and virtually every kind of terror attack in this country over the last 20, 25 years has been a quote-unquote false flag operation carried out by the U.S. government in order to so terrify us that we will accept gun control and the seizure of our guns, and so on and so forth. Jones also has put out several films claiming that the Federal Emergency Management Agency runs a secret set of concentration camps in the United States, and so on. This is the man who Donald Trump thinks has such a wonderful reputation, and he's so honored to be on his show. I guess all I can say is it's astounding. The idea that anyone with any political aspirations to be on the local sewer board would go on Alex Jones is quite incredible, let alone the nominee of the Republican Party of the United States for president. I'm not quite sure what to say. I mean, Jones isn't a Klansman. He's not a racist in that sense. But he is a man who engages in trafficking in total and utter falsehoods, the upshot of which is we need to be prepared to defend ourselves with weapons against the federal government.
And again, I'm speaking with Mark Potok, who's the director of the Southern Poverty Law Center's Intelligence Project and the editor of its award-winning quarterly investigative journal Intelligence Report. In addition to editing the magazine and the Hate Watch blog, Mark Potok acts as a key spokesman for the SPLC, a well-known civil rights organization based in Montgomery, Alabama, and he's testified before the Senate and the United Nations High Commission on Human Rights and other venues. So, but this is where I wonder about whether, as a country, we are a complete outlier, and I think a lot of it is to do with the zealous work of the NRA, which used to be a fairly mild-mannered organization dedicated to hunters and gun enthusiasts, and now has become a kind of rabid revolutionary organization. And by the way, they're about the only people really supporting Trump, and they've just put out a bunch of ads. But it seems to me they've created this kind of narrative that a lot of people in this country believe, that it's the sort of the Bundy narrative, if you will, that we all have to arm ourselves, not just to protect ourselves from the federal government, but to basically take on the federal government. I mean, where do you see the connections, if you do see any connections, between this kind of the Second Amendment fundamentalists that the NRA have been appealing to and the Bundy people? I don't see any difference.
No, I think there's a huge overlap. That seems obviously true. You know, let's remember the NRA has played an incredibly loathsome role in American society for quite a few years now. The first President Bush resigned the NRA after their boss, Wayne LaPierre, sent out a fundraising letter describing federal law enforcement agents as jackbooted thugs who wore Nazi bucket helmets and that sort of thing. So the NRA, in fact, has been promoting the idea of shooting anyone who gets in your way, essentially, but more specifically, of the idea that it will be the government who will be your enemy, you know, so-called Second Amendment solutions to problems of, unconstitutionality by the government or whatever it may be. And this idea of Second Amendment solutions has been parroted again and again and again, both by groups on the extreme right and by politicians on the far right. I think of Michel Fiore, a state senator or former state senator up in the Pacific Northwest, who said something to the effect of, were a police officer to point a gun at her, she would kill him. She was immediately denounced by the police organizations up there. And then she tried to claim that, oh, well, actually the only law enforcement official she would kill should he or she point a gun at her would be somebody from the Bureau of Land Management, which is, of course, the enemy of people like Clive and Bundy and the radicals in the kind of land use movement right now. So, I just think the NRA has been quite incredible. In the fall of 2008, when Barack Obama was first running for office, the NRA, along with a couple of firearms companies, ran a very large and expensive campaign called Prepare for the Storm. They didn't quite say, although I thought it was perfectly clear in terms of what they really meant, look out for the Negro who is about to become president of the United States. He will surely be coming for your guns, and you best be prepared. And, of course, many of us remember that there was an enormous run on ammunition and on weapons immediately after Obama's election because of this kind of fear-mongering.
But wasn't that pretty much what Donald Trump said a couple of days ago to the rally in North Carolina? He said basically the Second Amendment is over. You know, Hillary Clinton's going to take away the Second Amendment. She's going to.
Yeah, I mean, Donald Trump has simply bought into everything that comes out of the extreme right in this country. And, you know, the idea that he was not suggesting that someone might want to kill her is quite ridiculous. It was, I thought, perfectly plain what he said. His campaign's response that he just meant that he was calling for a unity among supporters of the Second Amendment to go out there and vote against Hillary Clinton, I think is an obvious bald-faced lie. That's simply not what he said. I think any person with two brain cells to rub together listening to his comments understood perfectly what he meant.
But anybody with two brain cells to rub together should surely know that Hillary Clinton can't snap her fingers and get rid of the Second Amendment, even if she wanted to, which she has clearly said she doesn't want to do.
That's right. And even Obama has been very, very loath to mess with gun control. In the wake of Orlando, he started talking about it to some extent for a little while, but it was so obviously hopeless in political terms that soon ended. And Hillary Clinton, it seems to me, is even further away from any real effort to impose anything beyond perhaps a slight tightening of some of the loopholes in background checks.
So what does this say then about Republicans? I know there's a lot of pressure on Paul Ryan every time Trump makes an outrageous statement. And the latest outrageous statement, of course, is that he says that both Hillary Clinton and Barack Obama created ISIS or Daesh or the Islamic State or whatever you want to call it. And he was given an opportunity by Hugh Hewitt on Hugh Hewitt's radio show to clarify, and Hewitt was giving him a softball way out, saying, I don't know what you mean. You mean that he created the vacuum, he lost the peace? In other words, giving Trump a way out. But Trump then went ahead, no, I mean that he, talking about Obama, is the founder of ISIS. I do. He was the most valuable player. I gave him the most valuable player award. I give her too, by the way, referring, of course, to Hillary Clinton. This is extraordinary rhetoric, but every time you hear this stuff, the reporters go to Ryan and the poor guy has to sort of squirm away and explain why he still endorses him. But former Arkansas Governor Mike Huckabee went after his fellow Republicans who aren't supporting Trump, saying they are not afraid he will lose. They are afraid he will win, Huckabee said, and upset their precious little world. So what do you think Huckabee's on about? I mean, where is the pushback going to come from that party, apart from the people who've quit, who are a substantial number of them? But do you see anybody with the moral authority, because it's an election year, it can't be Obama or Clinton to pull Trump over, but do you see anybody with the moral authority to pull this guy over on the Republican side?
No, not really. I mean, you know, as you say, a number of Republicans have left the party. Many have repudiated Trump. Others have withdrawn endorsements. But it seems to me we're at an end of that. You know, if, you know, it isn't enough to suggest that Hillary Clinton be assassinated or that Clinton and Barack Obama are the co-founders of ISIS, what is? I mean, these are falsehoods so wild and so unrestrained that if that kind of comment is not going to make you stand up against your party, I just don't know what will. So I think what we're witnessing is very likely the kind of nuclear meltdown of the Republican Party. I mean, I wonder what the party will look like after this election. Presumably, it's not possible. Well, it's possible, but presumably it's not likely that Trump will win. It does seem very likely that Republicans will lose the Senate and conceivably even the House. So I think at that point, I don't know if the Republicans will carry out another quote-unquote autopsy on their party, but at that point, it really may be dead.
Right, but isn't there also a possibility, since Donald Trump has already prepared his followers, and let's focus on his most ardent and highly armed followers, the David Dukes and other people like that who've expressed support for him, and the Sharon Engels who talk about Second Amendment remedies. Now that Trump has laid the groundwork for a defeat by saying the system is rigged, come November the 9th, is there a possibility, particularly if Trump continues this reckless behavior, and rather than give a concession speech to Hillary, who he's done everything he can to delegitimize, he basically says, you know, the whole thing is rigged and this is a disgrace and whatever, and in effect rile up these people, these highly people all across the country.
Yeah, I mean, it seems entirely possible. I mean, he and his surrogates have virtually said that already, that, you know, there will be riots. You know, initially that was said of, you know, if he was denied the Republican nomination, which, of course, he wasn't. But the same kinds of statements have been made by Trump and by others campaigning for Trump, suggesting that Americans will be so angry that they will take to the streets and that there will be a kind of revolution or some kind of street violence. You know, the shocking thing isn't even that some people see that as a possibility, but they virtually seem to be advocating it. So, you know, Trump, of course, has played a little game at not quite saying, not quite finishing his sentences, you know, when he makes these sort of remarks. But I think it's perfectly plain that that is what he's suggesting. And my feeling, just from watching Donald Trump over the months, is that he would probably get a great deal of enjoyment out of it were there to be a kind of battle in the streets, were people actually to be shooting one another. Because, after all, that would merely prove once again that he is, you know, the only person fit to be our leader, that he can predict the future. You know, he's so smart and so on.
Well, just in closing, Mark Potok, do you ever foresee that in America, we citizens can be safe on the streets of America from this highly armed population that have this incredibly paranoid mindset that the very government of the United States is dedicated to taking away their guns, even though there's absolutely zero evidence for it? And indeed, the Supreme Court held a decision, gives them the right to possess guns, and they're not happy with that. They still, NRA still puts out this paranoid delusion that there's this effort underway to take away their guns. And every time there's a massacre gun sales go through the roof and people even more highly armed. And essentially, we are reaching a point where we have an army within whose mental disposition is extremely frail, quite delusional, quite dangerous. And Donald Trump has changed the political narrative in a coarse and vulgar way, where he's perfectly capable of saying, let's go out and shoot the sons of bitches, you know?
Well, no, I don't think that we are particularly going to feel safe from that kind of violence in the future, in coming years. I mean, we as a nation have really made our bed, and I guess we're now going to have to lie in it. You know, that's not only the fact that we are literally awash in heavy weaponry, or even that we have a presidential candidate who is making these kinds of statements. You know, it's worth remembering that we've seen basically 20 or 30 years of this kind of talk about the government as the enemy, as being involved in conspiracies to deprive us of our liberties and, in many cases, our lives, that, you know, violence is the only answer. You know, I think maybe it's worth remembering that when Tim McVeigh murdered 168 people in Oklahoma City on April 19th of 1995, he was wearing a T-shirt with Thomas Jefferson's words printed on it to the effect of the tree of liberty must be watered, I think he said, from every 10 years, you know, with the blood of patriots and tyrants. That seems to be a little catchphrase that captures a lot of the reality of the mindset of literally millions of Americans. So, you know, it's not only Trump. You know, we've had a radical right movement that's been going for quite a while, pushing these kinds of ideas. That movement is aided and abetted by institutions like the National Rifle Association, by politicians like Sharon Angle and any number of others, very much including Donald Trump. And so, you know, this coarsening of the political system and political dialogue that you're talking about is something that has just been getting worse and worse and worse for many years. And in many ways, Donald Trump is the culmination of that.
And, of course, Jefferson's remark that the Tree of Liberty should be refreshed from time to time with the blood of patriots and tyrants, applying it to this conversation. The patriots are usurping the very word patriotism, and the tyrants are entirely imaginary. So there you have this hideous witch's brew, and I thank you for joining us, Mark Potok.
A pleasure. Thanks for having me.
And again, I've been speaking with Mark Potok, who's the director of the Southern Poverty Law Center's Intelligence Project and the editor of its award-winning quarterly investigative journal, Intelligence Report. In addition to editing the magazine and the Hate Watch blog, Potok acts as a key spokesperson for the SPLC, a well-known civil rights organization based in Montgomery, Alabama, and he's testified before the Senate, the United Nations High Commissioner on Human Rights, and other venues. We're going to take a brief station break. We'll be back looking further into whether Vladimir Putin is planning to restart his war with Ukraine.
You've been born with white skin, they explain, and the Negro's name is used, it is plain, for the politician's gain as he rises to fame, and the poor white remains on the caboose of the train, but it ain't him to blame. He's only a pawn in their game.
Hey, rejuvenation, the second wind. When will it begin? Repatriation, what is my sin? When will my ship come in?
Welcome back. I'm Ian Masters, and this is Background Briefing, available 24/7 at ianmasters.com. And joining us now is Andrew Cutchins, who's a senior fellow at the Center for Eurasian, Russian, and East European Studies at Georgetown University. His recent publications include Perspective, What's to Follow the Demise of the U.S.-Russia Reset, The End of the Reset, and Russian Foreign Policy, Continuity in Change. Welcome to Background Briefing, Andrew Cutchins.
Thanks again. Nice to be chatting with you again.
And likewise, Andrew, and I must say, though, I'm quite concerned about what seems to be happening in Crimea And the extent to which it's not getting a lot of attention, and I'm by extension, if the press aren't covering it, I'm not sure how much the foreign policy establishment is aware of what appears to be a real possibility that President Putin of Russia is using this ridiculous provocation that he refers to as an incursion as a pretext for war, which is what the Ukrainian leader is saying. But let's start with the provocations itself. What they've produced so far on Russian television, it's been heavily featured, is some sort of overweight Ukrainian guy with a gash on his forehead who supposedly created this incident, and all they provided is a bunch of soda bottles that were supposed to be homemade bombs that were going to create terror in Crimea. And this character's been identified as Yevgeny Panov. He apparently, his brother says, no, he was just visiting his country home in Crimea. And here he is being referred to in the Russian state media as a Ukrainian fascist, planning to move south in order to, you know, cause disruptions and et cetera. So the long and the short of it is it possible that given the history of what happened back in 2008 when Putin attacked Georgia in the middle of the Beijing Olympics, all of our political leaders, Obama is on vacation at Martha's Vineyard, could we be in for a surprise here?
Well, the analogy and the similarities to 2008 and other very unfortunate things that have happened in the month of August having to do with Russia are very, very worrisome. I completely agree with you, Ian, in that the Putin has used the opportunity to ratchet up the rhetoric in response to this alleged, you know, Ukrainian terrorist attack on the Crimean, Crimean-Ukrainian de facto border, to ratchet up the rhetoric to what we were hearing 2 years ago when the war was really raging in the Donbass. And, of course, we can't forget that, you know, actually the level of military incidents and the fighting in the Donbass has again increased quite significantly in the last month or so, to the east of where Crimea is. So, I was just emailing a friend suggesting that, you know, I think it would be worthwhile for President Obama to, you know, take some time out from one of his golf games at Martha's Vineyard to have a very quiet phone call with Mr. Putin, just to try to, prevent any drastic move on the part of the Russians in Ukraine. Because I think that it would be, there are a lot of different scenarios of what could happen. But, if we're talking about, again, the possible attempt to create a land bridge between Crimea and Russian territory, through the Donbass, that would be a massive, military undertaking with, I think quite disastrous military and economic consequences for Russians, Ukrainians, and others as well.
But that does appear to be, given the military buildup on this de facto border between Crimea and Ukraine, and the fact that there's a massive military base in Crimea itself, and in the entire Crimea since 2014 has been sealed up very tightly. And by the way, Russia has threatened to use nuclear weapons in defending Crimea if necessary. But in terms of this provocation, there has been no evidence provided by the FSB, the security service, who have said that one of their officers was killed along with a Russian soldier. So that's the pretext. So you have real doubts about that. But the sense that there may be a military attack as a sort of diversion on that de facto border and then a real attack from Donbass to open up a land bridge is something that I don't think can be discounted based upon the deployment of military assets. So
No, it definitely can't. Totally agree with you. It cannot be discounted. I think, you know, actually for the Russians to try to carry that out now would be harder today than it would have been 2 years ago or 2.5 years ago. The Ukrainian defenses, you know, around the border area with Crimea, as well as you know, throughout the country, have improved. But nevertheless, you know, look, Mr. Putin, you know, I would argue he made a real miscalculation in starting instigating the war in the Donbass and supporting the insurgents there in the spring of 2014. The other thing I would point to, Ian, as a concern, and maybe you know, is that the Russian parliamentary elections are being held in September 16th, and so we're in a political season. And so, you know, one explanation is that you know Mr. Putin is, you know, rattling the sabers to raise support for United Russia, his supported his party in the elections. But you know, you could also go further in using a military, you know, a sort of a terrorist act, provocation, et cetera. Because this also echoes very similar, you know, kind of what happened in the Georgia War in 2008, and it was basically what the Ukrainians need to be aware of. They have to be very disciplined and not allow themselves to be provoked by a Russian provocation. You know, that was the core mistake that Georgian President Saakashvili then made in 2008, and he was provoked and came across the border, and then the Russians used that as the pretext for their, you know, very, very significant invasion of Georgia.
No, some people at the time I spoke with referred to it as a sucker punch, but already, of course, Petro Poroshenko, the Ukrainian president, has said this is a pretext for more military threats against Ukraine, and he's put his troops in eastern Ukraine and on the border with Crimea on full combat alert. But what we're also hearing from on the Russian side is a little alarming. President Putin on Wednesday accused Ukraine of terrorism, and we are saying we obviously will not let such things slide by. There was a meeting on Thursday of the Russian Security Council, and they issued a statement saying scenarios were carefully considered for anti-terrorist security measures at the land border, in the waters, and in the airspace of Crimea. So is there also another factor in this? And the reason why the scenario of a 1-2 punch on the part of the Russians and trying to push through from Donbass into Crimea to create a land bridge, does it have anything to do with, and not that it's happening, and we're speculating here, but does it have anything to do with the fact that this bridge, which is referred to locally in Crimea as Putin's mm-hmm. bridge, that he contracted out to his crony, his best friend and judo partner, Arkady Rotenberg, and it's a 19-kilometer-long bridge, or a proposed bridge, costing $3.2 billion. It's an extremely difficult undertaking across the Kerch Strait, which has turbulent weather and ice flows, etc. But it's the only way that they can really sustain their occupation of Crimea, because it's proving to be incredibly costly, because the utilities come through Ukraine itself and they have to supply via ferry. And, of course, the ferries are packed now with military equipment, including, by the way, Putin's Nighthawks, you know, that motorcycle gang,
right.
His Hell's Angels.
Yep.
They've just shown up on Russian television thundering through Crimea. So so my understanding is that Putin's crony, Arkady Rotenberg, has stolen so much money from this project that it's literally going nowhere.
Well, I think the $3.2 billion is the number I've heard for the cost of the bridge are about twice that, between $6 and $7 billion. But anyway, it is very expensive. It's also, as you pointed out, that's very geologically, technologically, you know, from an engineering standpoint, very, very challenging to build. Nevertheless, though, I mean, the costs for Russia, militarily and economically, you know, would far outweigh, you know, the costs of the bridge, of building the bridge. I mean, I think, you know, I think eventually the bridge is going to get built. Although as you said at the outset, you can't discount the possibility of a premeditated attack, or also that even if it's not necessarily a provocation, but when you have militaries on both sides that are in such high levels of alert, close proximity increases the possibility that accidents can happen, that accidents then can have very, very precipitous and long-term disastrous effects.
Well, it seems to me, though, that things have changed in terms of Putin's attitudes in terms of this election. And there's been obviously a lot of coverage over here about Russian interference in this election. And you'd think that that would be something that Putin would be quite concerned about. But he said very little. And it seems that given the evidence, the forensic evidence of these hacks from the FSB and the GRU, Fancy Bear and Cozy Bear, that there was a deliberate effort on the part of the Russians to leave signatures, which normally doesn't happen when you do these hacks. You usually slip in without anybody knowing. You lurk for up to a year, steal everything you want, and then slip away without anybody noticing. There seemed to be a detectable difference. In other words, if you ask yourself, why would Putin want Trump elected, particularly now that Trump is doing so poorly? The only answer that I can come up with is that Putin doesn't give a damn anymore. He doesn't mind that his fingerprints are on this. He's basically saying, this is payback for you, Hillary Clinton, for what you did in 2011. Not that she necessarily did what he blames her for, but he honestly believes that she was the one who brought out hundreds of thousands of Russians to the streets to protest his continuation of his rule. So do you think that Putin is in fact tipping his hand here? He doesn't care, and he's deliberately sending a signal. Yeah, sure, I'm interfering with your elections because that's what you guys have done to me. And he goes, and you're responsible for the color revolutions, et cetera, et cetera. Do you think that that's what's going on?
Ian, it's now we're at the point of what is actually going on in Vladimir Putin's head, and what is he actually thinking? And so I have to go to the cop out. I don't know. But there's no question that over time, and particularly in the last few years, he has become less risk averse. And many of the risks that he has taken, from his standpoint, seem to have paid off. I think we also know that he is a kind of narcissistic personality, and pretty thin-skinned, and takes things personally. I've had people. So the question is to what extent he holds Hillary Clinton personally responsible, for the people who came out and the tens and hundreds of thousands of people that protested in response to the falsification of the parliamentary elections in the winter of 2011 and 2012. I can't say for sure, but I think the pattern of this is the danger of such a highly centralized decision making system, which so much power rests in the hands and the mind of this one man, So I don't have an answer to your question, but I share the concerns, and I spent a lot of time over the last 3 months interviewing policymakers in the past 25 years on the U.S. and the Russian side, more so on the U.S. side for a report I'm preparing on U.S.-Russia relations, kind of 25 years, what should we have learned? But, one of the things that has come up with several folks I've talked to on the U.S. side, and it's not news, is that, they're concerned about the information that Mr. Putin gets, and that some of it is really kind of wacko. I remember the comment that he made to George W. Bush years ago President Bush was responsible for Dan Rather's firing from CBS, and Bush was kind of looking like, "What are you talking about?" So there's a problem of information, no one really knows ultimately what Vladimir Putin is going to be doing. He's made a very successful political career out of surprising people and making people pay for underestimating him. Well, so this is a, yeah.
Well, I was going to say, you have described Vladimir Putin as a thin-skinned narcissist, Andrew Cutchins. That description would also be very apt for Donald Trump. So let's talk about this so-called relationship, which, I mean, it's pretty extraordinary to think that the American Republican Party, the GOP, at this point, if this is true, and it seems to be, their best hopes to have their candidate elected rest with the Russians and with Julian Assange. I mean, what's happening here? I mean, you think things are crazy in Russia? Things are pretty crazy over here.
Yeah, they are, and I have to admit that. I mean, there are so many questions and disturbing things that Mr. Trump has said, regarding Russia, regarding NATO, that it, sometimes if it looks, talks like a duck, it walks like a duck, it acts like a duck, you know, maybe it's a duck. I've experienced some very dark thoughts and concerns about the possibility of Mr. Trump wittingly or unwittingly doing the bidding of Vladimir Putin in Russia. And from a domestic political standpoint, you know, it doesn't make any sense really to cozy up to a Russian dictator. There's nothing to be had in American domestic politics, really for that. If you can trim away some of the more extreme, comments and the style of speaking of Mr. Trump, then you can make the case that what he's arguing for is a more constrained U.S. foreign policy, and one, which is more recognizes to a greater extent the limitations of U.S. power, and that contrasts with Hillary Clinton, who is more, it's not inaccurate to put her in sort of the liberal interventionist hawkish camp of the Democratic Party. And it is also interesting that although Bernie Sanders didn't touch much on foreign policy issues, to the extent that he did, I mean, he was critical in some of the same ways that Donald Trump has been critical of Mrs. Clinton, for her hawkish support for hawkish policies. But there are an awful lot of questions, and yes, and our side does look it's wacky. It's a scary time.
Well, just in closing, Andrew Cutchins, if there's anything to this scenario, that certainly there's evidence of a military buildup in Crimea, there's no question about it. But we're speculating about intentions here, and we simply don't know. But there's a historical parallel with August of 2008, et cetera. So let's finally look into what possible motives this would have. We know that it might certainly help distract the Russian people from the problems they have at home. It's a traditional idea that you have a war in order to distract people from bread and butter problems at home. But the Russian people are feeling very averse to a war, so they don't think they're going to be that thrilled unless it's a quick success like the Gulf War, and it may not be. But let's talk about Trump. How will this play with Trump? Because, he's rested his campaign pretty much on that he can take care of ISIS and Obama's a complete incompetent. And he's also extended that to Russia, saying he can work with Putin. And by the way, our policies are completely incompetent. So if a war breaks out and it whipsaws the American electorate, could it be that Trump could come out ahead on this by the fact, and unless the President Obama says something soon and puts Putin on notice and it happens, I don't know that there's a lot the U.S. could do, is there?
To prevent it from happening? We're not going to get militarily involved and send, U.S. troops, to fight on Ukrainian territory against the Russians. Again, the risk of escalation to to a nuclear confrontation is just far too risky. You know, how it's going to play out. You know, it's certainly true that I think that you know, over the course of the primary campaign, you know, terrorist attacks taking place and in Europe and in the United States, actions that happen that make the American people feel less secure, they played into the favor, I think, of Donald Trump dealing with his adversaries in the Republican Party. It's a little tougher to see how this could play out with his adversary being Hillary Clinton, who's already kind of put herself, you know, a bit into a more hawkish position than President Obama. I think let me say one other thing before I conclude. Is one, I'm not. It's not entirely clear to me, actually, that it would that a Trump presidency would be better for Mr. Putin than a Hillary Clinton presidency, because Mr. Trump is so unpredictable and so volatile, and I think thin-skinned that there are a number of serious Russian figures who argue that the Russians would actually prefer, you know, something more predictable, something more professional, something more competent, you know, even if they view this person as would be taking a somewhat tougher line on Russia. So put that out there. But the perception that it would be an awfully risky play. And so my hope, Ian, is that that the saber rattling that Mr. Putin is doing right now in Ukraine will be limited to saber rattling, and it is primarily designed for pumping up a little more support as Russia goes into its parliamentary elections a month from now.
Well, Andrew Cutchins, I thank you very much for joining us.
Thank you, Ian. It's been a pleasure talking. And
well, I hope neither of us are right in our concerns. And I thank you for joining us. Again, I've been speaking with Andrew Cutchins, who's a senior fellow at the Center for Eurasian, Russian, and East European Studies at Georgetown University. And his recent publications include Perspective, What's to Follow the Demise of the U.S.-Russian Reset, and The End of the Reset, and Russian Foreign Policy, Continuity in Change. We're going to take a brief station break. We're back looking into the just-released damning report by the Department of Justice on the Baltimore Police Department.
I have breathed all the sea. You're our fan prophecy. Our destiny we will not hide. When the sun comes up, it will be on your side.
Are you really for peace and equality? Or when my car's hooked up, you know you want to follow me. Your laws are minimal, cause you won't even think about looking at the real criminal. This has got to cease, cause we be getting hyped to the sound of the police. Whoop, whoop. That's the sound of the police. Whoop, whoop. That's the sound of the beast. Whoop, whoop. That's the sound of the police. Whoop, whoop. That's the sound of the beast. There's a little truth. Open up your eye while you're checking out the boombox.
Welcome back. I'm Ian Masters, and this is Background Briefing, available 24/7 at ianmasters.com. And joining us now is Kenneth Burns, a reporter for WYPR covering Baltimore City and Baltimore County. He is a member of the Society of Professional Journalists, the National Association of Black Journalists, and the Online News Association. He also writes about Maryland politics at mdpoliticsblog.com. Welcome to Background Briefing, Kenneth Burns.
Thank you for having me.
And what do you make of the DOJ's report on the Baltimore police? They've been monitoring, the Department of Justice has been monitoring the Baltimore Police Department's policing methods for more than a year at the request of the Baltimore Police Department after the 2015 death of Freddie Gray, who, of course, suffered fatal injuries while in police custody, yet all those that were charged were acquitted. So what's your take on it, Kenneth?
Well, there's nothing really surprising in the report. This, for a lot of people, this just confirms what has been known, particularly in neighborhoods like where Freddie Gray was arrested, for decades at this point. The mayor called in the Justice Department. It was supposed to be a collaborative review. where the two sides kind of work together and the Justice Department pretty much gives the equivalent of suggestions, nothing that could be enforceable in court. But once the six officers were charged in Freddie Gray's death, that's when the Justice Department turned that collaborative review into a full-scale civil rights investigation or a pattern and practice investigation. So luckily for Baltimore, the mayor wanted to improve the police department, and she has a police commissioner that has gone through this before in another jurisdiction. But now you have federal government will make the Baltimore Police Department change their practices and reform.
And how is the Baltimore State's Attorney, Marilyn Mosby, who's been pretty much vilified by police departments across the country, how is she responding to this DOG report?
Police departments and some attorneys who felt that she rushed to judgment. She didn't do a proper investigation. She issued a statement ahead of the report officially coming out on Wednesday, as she said that she pretty much backs up the report and looks forward to the reforms coming out of the police department.
So some of the findings, and there's an awful lot, a huge long list of criticisms here of the Baltimore police from this DOJ report. One, of course, is that there was one African-American man in his 50s was stopped 30 times in 5 years without an arrest. That seems to be very much the pattern here, isn't it? Is that what you see in this report of just enormous a number of citizens being hassled and with thousands and thousands of police stops and I think, 3% of these stops yielded any arrest?
Well, Ian, let's put this in a little bit more of a perspective. Those stops disproportionately, according to this report, affected African-American residents. And in one case, they cited that nearly half of the pedestrian stops, some 300,000, most of them came from two majority black districts that are relatively small compared with the entire city population, 11%. And then on top of that, they also cited that the same aggressive tactics that officers would use on adults, they also used on youth. And I don't know how far back your recollection is when Martin O'Malley, who ran for president recently, he was the mayor of Baltimore, and he was a proponent of zero-tolerance policing. And the report said that further eroded the trust between officers and the community. And even to this day, that legacy of zero-tolerance policing still remains in some neighborhoods.
But the result of zero-tolerance policing is you end up harassing the very people that you're supposed to serve.
You harass them, and in some cases you have people with arrest records or some people just charged with just small crimes, like failure to obey, resisting arrest, stuff like that. They have arrest records and, in some instances, criminal records, and it's also contributing to a lack of being able to get a job.
Right, but the report finds that only 3.7 of all of these stops resulted in citations or arrests. So that's the proof that, you know, you're not necessarily stopping people because they're committing a crime. You're stopping them for some other reason.
Right, but again, you have an arrest record. I mean, you might not have been charged, but you were detained. Right. You still have that record to contend with.
Right, I understand. But I have more sympathy for people that don't have an arrest record. And that's what I think is outrageous about this report.
Well, in the grand scheme of things, will they still be able to get a job?
Well, that's true, and I imagine...
You have to think about that as well. And considering that Baltimore is, particularly in those neighborhoods, the unemployment levels are disproportionately high, feeds into this complex situation that Baltimore finds herself in. High crime with a police department that is now known to have violated the civil rights of the majority of its African-American citizens. And part of the problem is a lack of education opportunities, a lack of job opportunities, and a lack of housing opportunities.
Right, but those, everything you've listed, you can't necessarily blame them on the police, can you?
No. I mean, it's a complicated, like I said, it's a complicated mess. And even the report said that many of the police officers in these neighborhoods, they have a hard job as it is because, one, they're fighting crime, but then, two, they're dealing with these social issues that have lingered for a long, long time. Many of these issues before some of these officers were born. Heck, even before I was born. I was born in 81.
So, you know, when I'm listening to you, Kenneth Burns here again, who is a reporter for WYPR covering Baltimore City and Baltimore County. He's a member of the Society of Professional Journalists and the National Association of Black Journalists and the Online News Association. Has also written about Maryland politics at mdpoliticsblog.com. Well, just listening to what you're telling us here, Kenneth, I'm reminded of the TV series, The Wire, and that was a few years back. So is the environment that described still the environment that we're talking about here?
Very much so, sad as I want to admit it, only because I think there's a difference between television and real life. However, The Wire is based on real life. In fact, The Wire was written by David Simon, a former reporter with the Baltimore Sun. So there's a little bit of reality interspersed with The Wire. And that's the popular question that I do get every now and then, either in joking or in seriousness. Is Baltimore really like The Wire? It's not all like The Wire, but this report pretty much gives into that stereotype. Also keep in mind, in terms of the media perception of Baltimore, David Zurawick, he's a media critic for the same newspaper. Just as an aside, he said that after yesterday or after Wednesday, no politician in Baltimore could say it's a few bad apples or it's a bad media perception, because the report basically said that the perception is the reality.
And how's the police commissioner saying handling it? He said he's fired six people, but apparently he hasn't.
Well, he's fired six people this year. There was some misreporting done because he mentioned it during the police during the news conference. In fact, it was my colleague who asked him, "Does this mean that residents could expect you to clean house?" And the police commissioner Kevin Davis said, I fired six people this year already, and I'm committed to holding officers accountable. So even before the report, you had six police officers that were fired before the report came out.
But none since, and the report is pretty damning.
It's pretty damning, but also remember, we've only had the report for a day and a half, hours before the news conference. So you figured sometime late Tuesday, early Wednesday, when he finally had his hands on it.
Well, Kenneth Burns, I thank you for filling us in, and let's stay in touch, okay?
Absolutely.
And again, I've been speaking with Kenneth Burns, who's a reporter for WYPR, covering Baltimore City and Baltimore County. He's a member of the Society of Professional Journalists, the National Association of Black Journalists, and the Online News Association, and he also writes about Maryland politics at mdpoliticsblog.com. This has been Background Briefing. I'm Ian Masters. I'd like to thank producer Graham Fitzgibbon. This program is available for podcasting at ianmasters.com. You can also contact me and scroll down the right-hand side and sign up for iTunes podcasts. And I'll be back again with another Background Briefing. Bye for now.